This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Tales of the Peculiar by Millard Nollings and Ransom Riggs. Read for you by Simon Callow. With Bruce Mann and Garrick Hagen.
To Alma Le Fay Peregrine, who taught me to love tales. Millard Nollings.
Homo sum. Humani nil a me alienum puto. Terence.
Dear listener, the audiobook you are listening to is meant for peculiar ears only. If by chance you are not among the ranks of the anomalous, in other words, if you don't find yourself floating out of bed in the middle of the night because you forgot to tie yourself to the mattress, sprouting flames from the palms of your hands at inopportune times, or chewing food with the mouth in the back of your head, then please put this book back where you found it at once and forget this ever happened. Don't worry, you won't be missing anything. I'm sure you'd only find the stories contained herein strange, distressing, and altogether not to your liking. And anyway, they're none of your business. Very peculiarly yours, the publisher.
Forward. If you are of the peculiar persuasion, and if you've read this far, I sincerely hope that you are, then this is a book that likely needs no introduction. These tales were a formative and beloved part of your upbringing, and you came of age reading them and hearing them read aloud with such frequency that you can recite your favourites word for word. If, however, you are among those unfortunates who have only just discovered their peculiarity, or who grew up in circumstances where no peculiar literature was available, I offer this brief primer. Tales of the Peculiar is a collection of our most beloved folklore, passed down from generation to generation since time immemorial. Each story is part history, part fairy tale, and part moral lesson aimed at young peculiars. These tales hail from various parts of the globe, from oral as well as written traditions, and have gone through striking transformations over the years. They have survived as long as they have, because they are loved for their merits as stories, but they are more than that too. They are also the bearers of secret knowledge. Encoded within their pages are the locations of hidden loops, the secret identities of certain important peculiars, and other information that could aid a peculiar's survival in this hostile world. I should know. The tales are the reason I'm alive to write these words now. They preserve not only my life, but those of my friends and our beloved Imbrin. I, Millard Nollings, am a living testament to the enduring usefulness of these stories, though they were written many years ago. That's why I've devoted myself to their preservation and dissemination, and taken it upon myself to edit and annotate this special edition of the tales. It is by no means exhaustive or complete. The edition I grew up reading was a famously unwieldy three-volume set that weighed, collectively, more than my friend Bronwyn. But the stories contained here represent my very favourites, and I have taken the liberty of annotating them with historical and contextual insights, so that peculiars everywhere may benefit from my wisdom. It's also my hope that this edition, being more portable than previous ones, will be an easy companion on your travels and adventures, and may prove itself as useful to you as it once did to me. So, please enjoy these tales, before a crackling fire on a chilly night, ideally, a snoring grim bear at your feet. But remember, too, their sensitive nature, and if you must read them aloud, which I highly recommend, make certain your audience is peculiar. Millard Nollings, Esquire, EDD, MBCH.
The Splendid Cannibals. The peculiars in the village of Swampmuck lived very modestly. They were farmers, and though they didn't own fancy things and lived in flimsy houses made of reeds, they were healthy and joyful and wanted for little. Food grew bountifully in their gardens, clean water ran in the streams, and even their humble homes seemed like luxuries because the weather in Swamp Muck was so fair, and the villagers were so devoted to their work that many, after a long day of mucking, would simply lie down and sleep in their swamps. Harvest was their favourite time of year. Working round the clock, they gathered the best weeds that had grown in the swamp that season, bundled them onto donkey carts, and drove their bounty to the market town of Chipping Whippet, a 5 days' ride, to sell what they could. It was difficult work. The swamp weed was rough and tore their hands. The donkeys were ill-tempered and apt to bite. The road to market was pitted with holes and plagued by thieves. There were often grievous accidents, such as when Farmer Pullman, in a fit of overzealous harvesting, accidentally scythed off his neighbour's leg. The neighbour, Farmer Hayworth, was understandably upset, but the villagers were such agreeable people that all was soon forgiven. The money they earned at market was paltry, but enough to buy necessities and some rations of goat rump besides, and with that rare treat as their centrepiece, they threw a raucous festival that went on for days. That very year, just after the festival had ended and the villagers were about to return to their toil in the swamps, three visitors arrived. Swamp Muck rarely had visitors of any kind, as it was not the sort of place people wanted to visit, and it had certainly never had visitors like these. Two men and a lady dressed head to toe in lush brocaded silk, riding on the backs of three fine Arabian horses. But though the visitors were obviously rich, they looked emaciated and swayed weakly in their bejewelled saddles. The villagers gathered round them curiously, marvelling at their beautiful clothes and horses.
"Don't get too close," Farmer Sally warned. "They look as if they might be sick."
"We're on a journey to the coast of Meek," explained one of the visitors, a man who seemed to be the only one strong enough to speak. "We were accosted by bandits some weeks ago, and though we were able to outrun them, we got badly lost. We've been turning circles ever since, looking for the old Roman road."
"You're nowhere near the Roman road," said Farmer Sally. "Or the coast of Meek," said Farmer Pullman.
"How far is it?" the visitor asked.
6 days' ride," answered Farmer Sally.
"We'll never make it," the man said darkly. At that, the silk-robed lady slumped in her saddle and fell to the ground. The villagers, moved to compassion, despite their concerns about disease, brought the fallen lady and her companions into the nearest house. They were given water and made comfortable in beds of straw, and a dozen villagers crowded around them offering help.
"Give them space," said Farmer Pullman. "They're exhausted. They need rest."
"No, they need a doctor," said Farmer Sally.
"We aren't sick," the man said. "We're hungry. Our supplies ran out over a week ago, and we haven't had a bite to eat since then."
Farmer Sally wondered why such wealthy people hadn't simply bought food from fellow travellers on the road, but she was too polite to ask. Instead, she ordered some village boys to run and fetch bowls of swampweed soup and millet bread and what little goat rump was left over from the festival. But when it was laid before the visitors, they turned the food away.
"I don't mean to be rude," said the man, "but we can't eat this."
"I know it's a humble spread," said Farmer Sally, "and you're probably used to feasts fit for kings, but it's all we have."
"It isn't that," the man said. "Grains, vegetables, animal meat, our bodies simply can't process them. And if we force ourselves to eat, it will only make us weaker."
The villagers were confused.
"If you can't eat grains, vegetables, or animals," asked Farmer Pullman, "then what can you eat?"
"People," the man replied.
Everyone in the small house took a step back from the visitors.
"You mean to tell us you're cannibals?" said Farmer Hayworth.
"By nature, not by choice,"
the man replied. But yes. He went on to reassure the shocked villagers that they were civilized cannibals and never killed innocent people. They, and others like them, had worked out an arrangement with the king by which they agreed never to kidnap and eat people against their will, and in turn they were allowed to purchase, at terrific expense, the severed limbs of accident victims and the bodies of hanged criminals. This composed the entirety of their diet. They were now on their way to the coast of Meek, because it was the place in Britain that boasted both the highest rate of accidents and the most deaths by hanging, and so food was relatively abundant, if not exactly plentiful. Even though cannibals in those days were wealthy, they nearly always went hungry. Firmly law-abiding, they were doomed to live lives of perpetual undernourishment, forever tormented by an appetite they could rarely satisfy. And it seemed that the cannibals who had arrived in Swamp Muck, already starving and many days from Meek, were now doomed to die. Having learned all this, the people of any other village, peculiar or otherwise, would have shrugged their shoulders and let the cannibals starve. But the Swamp Muckians were compassionate almost to a fault, and so no one was surprised when Farmer Hayworth took a step forward, hobbling on crutches, and said, "It just so happens that I lost my leg in an accident a few days ago. I tossed it into the swamp, but I'm sure I can find it again, if the eels haven't eaten it yet." The cannibal's eyes brightened. "You would do that?" the cannibal woman said, brushing long hair back from a skeletal cheek. "I admit it feels a little strange," Hayworth said, "but we can't just let you die." The other villagers agreed. Hayworth hobbled to the swamp and found his leg, fought off the eels that were nibbling at it, and brought it to the cannibals on a platter. One of the cannibal men handed Hayworth a purse of money.
"What's this?" asked Hayworth.
"Payment," the cannibal man said.
"The same amount the king charges us." "I can't accept this," said Hayworth,
but when he tried to return the purse, the cannibal put his hands behind his back and smiled.
"It's only fair," the cannibal said. "You've saved our lives."
The villagers turned away politely as the cannibals began to eat. Farmer Hayworth opened the purse, looked inside, and turned a bit pale. It was more money than he'd ever seen in his life. The cannibals spent the next few days eating and recovering their strength. And when they were finally ready to set off again for the coast of Meek, this time with good directions, the villagers all gathered to wish them goodbye. When the cannibals saw Farmer Hayworth, they noticed he was walking without the aid of crutches.
"I don't understand," said one of the cannibal men, astounded. "I thought we ate your leg." "You did," said Hayworth. "But when the peculiars of Swamp Muck lose their limbs, they grow them back again."
The cannibal got a funny look on his face, seemed about to say more, then thought better of it. And he got on his horse and rode away with the others. Weeks passed. Life in Swamp Muck returned to normal for everyone but Farmer Hayworth. He was distracted, and during the day he could often be found leaning on his mucking stick, gazing out over the swamps. He was thinking about the purse of money, which he'd hidden in a hole. What should he do with it? His friends all made suggestions.
"You could buy a wardrobe of beautiful clothes," said Farmer Bettelheim. "But what would I do with them?" Farmer Hayworth replied. "I work in the swamps all day. They would only get ruined." "You could buy a library of fine books," suggested Farmer Hagel. "But I can't read," replied Hayworth, "and neither can anyone in Swamp Muck."
Farmer Batchelard's suggestion was silliest of all.
"You should buy an elephant," he said, "and use it to haul all your swamp weeds to market." "But it would eat all the swamp weeds before I could sell it," said Hayworth, becoming exasperated. "If only I could do something about my house. The reeds do little to keep the wind out, and it gets drafty in the winter." "You could use the money to paper the walls," said Farmer Anderson. "Don't be an idiot," Farmer Sally piped up. "Just buy a new house."
And that's exactly what Hayworth did. He built a house made of wood, the first ever constructed in swamp muck. It was small but sturdy and kept out the wind, and it even had a door that swung open and shut on hinges. Farmer Hayworth was very proud, and his house was the envy of the entire village. Some days later, another group of visitors arrived. There were four of them, three men and a woman, and because they were dressed in fine clothes and rode on Arabian horses, the villagers knew right away who they were, law-abiding cannibals from the coast of Meek. These cannibals, however, did not appear to be starving. Again the villagers gathered round to marvel at them. The cannibal woman, who wore a shirt spun with gold thread, pants buttoned with pearls, and boots trimmed with fox fur, said, "Friends of ours came to your village some weeks ago, and you showed them great kindness. Because we are not a people accustomed to kindness, we have come to thank you in person." And the cannibals got down from their horses and bowed to the villagers, then went about shaking the villagers' hands. The villagers were amazed at the softness of the cannibal's skin. "One more thing before we go," said the cannibal woman. "We heard you have a unique talent. Is it true you regrow lost limbs?" The villagers told them it was true. "In that case," the woman said, "we have a modest proposal for you. The limbs we eat on the coast of Meek are rarely fresh, and we're tired of rotten food. Would you sell us some of yours? We would pay handsomely, of course." She opened her saddle pack to reveal a wad of money and jewels. The villagers goggled at the money, but they felt uncertain and turned away to whisper amongst themselves. "We can't sell our limbs," Farmer Pullman reasoned. "I need my legs for walking." "Then only sell your arms," said Farmer Batchelard. "But we need our arms for swamp mucking," said Farmer Hayworth. "If we're being paid for our arms, we won't need to grow swamp weed any more," said Farmer Anderson. "We hardly earn anything from farming anyway."
"Doesn't seem right selling ourselves that way," said Farmer Hayworth.
"Easy for you to say," said Farmer Bettelheim. "You've got a house made of wood."
And so the villagers made a deal with the cannibals. Those who were right-handed would sell their left arms, and those who were left-handed would sell their right arms, and they'd keep on selling them as they grew back. That way they'd have a steady source of income and would never again have to spend all day mucking or endure a difficult harvest. Everyone seemed pleased with the arrangement except Farmer Hayworth, who rather enjoyed swamp mucking and was sorry to see the village give up its traditional trade, even if it wasn't very profitable compared to selling one's limbs to cannibals. But there was nothing Farmer Hayworth could do, and he watched helplessly as all his neighbours gave up farming, let their swamps go fallow, and hacked their arms off. Their peculiarity was such that it didn't hurt much, and the limbs came off rather easily, like a lizard's tail. They used the money they earned to buy food from the market at Chipping Whippet. Goat rump became a dish eaten daily rather than annually, and to build houses made of wood like Farmer Hayworth's. Everyone wanted a door that swung on hinges, of course. Then Farmer Pullman built a house with two floors, and soon everyone wanted a house with two floors. Then Farmer Sally built a house with two floors and a gabled roof, and soon everyone wanted houses with two floors and a gabled roof. Every time the villagers' arms regrew and were hacked off and sold again, they would use the money to add to their houses. Finally, the houses grew so big that there was hardly any room between them, and the village square, once wide and open, was reduced to a narrow alley. Farmer Batchelard was the first one to hit upon a solution. He would buy a big plot of land on the outskirts of the village and build a new house there, even larger than his current one, which had, incidentally, three doors that swung on hinges, two floors, a gabled roof, and a porch. This was around the time when the villagers stopped going by Farmer This and Farmer That and started calling themselves Mr. This and Mrs. That, because they were no longer farmers, except for Farmer Hayworth, who kept on mucking his swamp and refused to sell any more limbs to the cannibals. He liked his simple house just fine, he insisted, and didn't even use it that much because he still enjoyed sleeping in his swamp after a hard day's work. His friends thought him silly and old-fashioned, and stopped coming by to see him. The once humble village of Swamp Muck expanded rapidly as villagers bought larger and larger tracts of land upon which they built larger and more ornate houses. To finance this, they began selling the cannibals both an arm and a leg. The leg always on the opposite side from the arm to make balancing easier, and learned to get around on crutches. The cannibals, whose hunger and wealth both seemed inexhaustible, were very happy with this. Then Mr. Pullman tore down his wooden house and replaced it with one made of brick, which touched off a race amongst the villagers to see who could build the grandest brick house. But Mr. Bettelheim bested them all. He built a beautiful house made of honey-coloured limestone, the sort of home only the richest merchants in Chipping Whippet lived in. He had afforded it by selling his arm and both of his legs.
"He's gone too far," complained Mrs. Sally over goat-rump sandwiches and the fancy new restaurant the village had built.
Her friends agreed.
"How does he plan to enjoy his three-floor house?" said Mrs. Wanamaker, "if he can't even walk up the stairs."
It was just at that moment that Mr. Bettelheim came into the restaurant, carried by a burly man from the neighbouring village.
"I've hired a man to carry me up and down the stairs and anywhere else I want to go," he said proudly. "I don't need legs."
The ladies were astounded. But soon they had sold their legs too. And all across the village, brick houses were being torn down and replaced by giant houses made of limestone. The cannibals, by this time, had abandoned the coast of Meek to live in the forest near Swamp Muck. There was no point any more in subsisting on a meagre diet of hanged criminals and accident victims' limbs, when the villagers' limbs were fresher, tastier, and more plentiful than anything available in Meek. Their forest homes were modest, because they gave so much of their money to the villagers, but the cannibals were nevertheless content, much happier to live in huts with full bellies than to go hungry in mansions. As the villagers and cannibals came to depend on one another, the appetites of each continued to grow. The cannibals became fat. Having exhausted every recipe they had for arms and legs, they began to wonder what the villagers' ears tasted like. But the villagers would not sell them their ears, because ears did not grow back. That is, until Mr. Batchelard, carried in the arms of his burly servant, paid a secret visit to the cannibals' forest and asked them how much they'd be willing to pay. He'd still be able to hear without his ears, he reasoned, and though it would make him a bit ugly, the fine house of white marble he'd be able to construct with the proceeds would be beautiful enough to compensate. Now, the financially astute among you may be asking, why didn't Mr. Batchelard just save up money from the ongoing sale of his arms and legs until he could afford a marble house? It's because he couldn't save money. Because he'd taken out a very large loan from a bank in order to buy the land upon which his limestone house was built. And now he owed the bank an arm and a leg every month, just to pay interest on the loan. So he needed to sell his ears. The cannibals offered Mr. Batchelard an exorbitant sum. Mr. Batchelard snipped off his ears, happy to be rid of them, and replaced his limestone house with the marble home of his dreams. It was the most beautiful house in the village, and perhaps in all of Oddfordshire. Though the villagers of Swamp Muck talked behind Batchelard's back about how ugly he'd made himself, and how foolish it was to sell ears that would never grow back, they all paid him visits, and had their servants carry them through the marble rooms and up and down the marble staircases, and by the time they left, each was green with envy. By this time, none of the villagers but Farmer Hayworth had legs, and very few had arms. For a while they all insisted on keeping one arm, so that they could point at things and feed themselves, but then they realized that a servant could lift a spoon or a glass to their lips just as easily, and it was not much more trouble to say, "Fetch this for me," or "Fetch that for me," than to point across a room at something. so arms became seen as needless luxuries, and the villagers, reduced to limbless torsos, would travel from place to place in silken sacks slung across their servants' shoulders. Ears soon went the way of arms. The villagers pretended they had not called Mr. Batchelard ugly.
"He doesn't look so bad," said Mr. Bettelheim.
"We could wear earmuffs," suggested Mr. Anderson.
And so their ears were snipped and sold, and marble houses were built. The village gained a reputation for its architectural beauty, and what had once been a backwater visited only by accident became a tourist destination. A hotel was built, and several more restaurants. Goat rump sandwiches were not even on the menu. The people of Swampmuck pretended they had never even heard of goat rump sandwiches. Tourists sometimes lingered near Farmer Hayworth's modest, flat-roofed house of wood, curious about the contrast between his simple home and the palaces that surrounded it. He would explain that he preferred the simple life of a four-limbed swamp-weed farmer and show them around his patch of swamp. His was the last bit of swamp in Swamp Muck, as all the others had been filled in with dirt to make room for houses. The eyes of the country were on Swamp Muck and its beautiful marble homes. The home's owners loved the attention, but were desperate to stand out in some way, as every house was nearly identical. Each wanted to be known as the owner of the most beautiful house in Swamp Muck, but they were already using their arms and legs every month just to pay interest on their enormous loans, and they had already sold their ears. They began to approach the cannibals with new ideas.
"Would you loan me money with my nose as collateral?" asked Mrs. Sally.
"No," the cannibals said,
"but we would happily buy your nose outright." "But if I cut my nose off, I'll look like a monster," she said. "You could wear a scarf around your face," they suggested.
Mrs. Sally refused, and from her sack she instructed her servant to take her home. Next, Mr. Bettelheim came to see the cannibals.
"Would you buy my nephew?"
he whispered, his servant pushing an 8-year-old boy before the cannibals.
"Absolutely not," the cannibals replied,
and gave the terrified boy a candy before sending him home. Mrs. Sally returned a few days later.
"Okay," she said with a sigh, "I'll sell you my nose."
She had it replaced with a false one made of gold, and with the money she earned, built an enormous gold dome on top of her marble house. You may have guessed where this is going. The whole village sold their noses and built gold domes and turrets and towers. Then they sold their eyes, just one each, and used the money to dig moats round their houses, which they filled with wine and exotic, drunken fish. They said that binocular vision was a luxury anyway, and needed mainly for throwing and catching things, which, lacking arms, they didn't do any more. And it only took one eye to appreciate the beauty of their homes. Now, the cannibals were civilized and law-abiding, but they weren't saints. They were living in huts in the forest and cooking their food over campfires, while the villagers lived in manors and palaces, waited on by servants. So the cannibals moved into the villagers' houses. There were so many rooms in the houses that it took the villagers some time to notice, but when they finally did, they were angry.
"We never said you could live with us," the villagers said. "You're dirty cannibals who eat human flesh. Go stay in the woods."
"If you don't let us live in your houses," the cannibals replied, "we'll stop buying your limbs and go back to Meek. Then you won't be able to pay your loans, and you'll lose everything."
The villagers didn't know what to do. They didn't want cannibals in their houses, but neither could they imagine going back to the way they used to live. In fact, things would be worse than before. Not only would they be homeless, disfigured, and half-blind, but they wouldn't even have swamps to farm, because they'd filled them all in. It was unthinkable. Grudgingly, they let the cannibals stay. The cannibals spread out among all the houses in the village, except Farmer Hayworth's. No one wanted to live in his crude wooden shack. They took the master suites and largest bedrooms, and made the villagers move into their own guest rooms, some of which did not even have ensuite bathrooms. Mr. Batchelard was forced to live in his chicken coop. Mr. Anderson moved into his cellar. It was very nice for a cellar, but still. The villagers complained incessantly about the new arrangement. They still had tongues, after all.
"Your cooking smells make me sick," Mrs. Sally said to her cannibals. "The tourists keep asking about you, and it's embarrassing!"
Mr. Pullman shouted at his cannibals, startling them as they read quietly in the study.
"If you don't move out, I'll tell the authorities you've been kidnapping children and cooking them into quiches,"
Mr. Bettelheim threatened.
"One doesn't cook a quiche. One bakes a quiche," replied his cannibal,
a cultivated Spaniard named Hector.
"I don't care!"
shouted Mr. Bettelheim, going quite red in the face. After some weeks of this, Hector decided he couldn't take it any more. He offered Mr. Bettelheim every penny he had left on earth if he would just sell Hector his tongue. Mr. Bettelheim did not reject the offer out of hand. He gave it careful thought and consideration. Without his tongue, he'd no longer be able to complain or make threats against Hector. But with the money Hector was promising, he could build a second house on his property and live there, away from Hector, and he'd no longer have anything to complain about. And who else in the village would have not one, but two golden-domed marble houses? Now, if Mr. Bettelheim had asked Farmer Hayworth's advice, his old friend would have told him not to take the cannibal's deal.
"If the smell of Hector's cooking bothers you, come and live with me," Hayworth would have offered. "I have more than enough room in my house."
But Mr. Bettelheim had shunned Farmer Hayworth, as had the rest of the village, so he didn't ask. And even if he had, Bettelheim was too proud and would rather live without a tongue than in Hayworth's sad little house. So Bettelheim went to Hector and said,
"Okay."
Hector drew his carving knife, which was always sheathed at his side.
"Yes,"
Bettelheim said, and stuck out his tongue. Hector did the deed. He stuffed Bettelheim's mouth with cotton to stop the bleeding. He carried the tongue into the kitchen, fried it in truffle oil with a pinch of salt, and ate it. Then he took all the money he'd promised Bettelheim, gave it to Bettelheim's servants, and dismissed them. Limbless, tongueless, and very angry, Bettelheim grunted and wiggled around on the floor. Hector picked him up, carried him outside, and tied him to a stake in a shady part of the back garden. He watered and fed Bettelheim twice a day, and like a fruiting vine, Bettelheim grew limbs for Hector to eat. Hector felt a little bad about it, but not too bad. Eventually he married a nice cannibal girl, and together they raised a cannibal family, all fed by the peculiar man in the back garden. Such was the fate of all the villagers, all but Farmer Hayworth, who kept his limbs and lived in his little house and farmed his swamp like he always had. He didn't bother his new neighbours, and they didn't bother him. He had everything he needed, and so did they. And they lived happily ever after. The Fork-Tongued Princess. In the ancient kingdom of Frankenburg, there was a princess who had a peculiar secret. In her mouth hid a long, forked tongue, and across her back lay shimmering, diamond-patterned scales. Because she had developed these serpentine characteristics during her teenage years and rarely opened her mouth for fear of being found out, she had been able to keep them secret from everyone but her handmaiden. Not even her father, the king, knew. It was a lonely life for the princess, as she rarely spoke to anyone for fear they'd catch a glimpse of her forked tongue. But her real trouble was this. She was to be married to a prince from Galatia. They'd never seen each other, but her beauty was so renowned that he'd agreed to the match anyway, and they were to meet for the first time on their wedding day, which was fast approaching. Their union would cement relations between Frankenburg and Galatia, ensure prosperity for both regions, and create a pact of defense against their hated mutual enemy, the warlike principality of Frisia. The princess knew the marriage was politically necessary, but she was terrified the prince would reject her once he discovered her secret.
"Don't worry," counseled her handmaiden. "He'll see your beautiful face, come to know your beautiful heart, and forgive the rest."
"And if he doesn't?" the princess replied. "Our best hope for peace will be ruined, and I'll live the rest of my day as a spinster." The kingdom prepared for a royal wedding. The palace was hung with golden silks, and chefs from across the land came to prepare a lavish feast. Finally, the prince arrived with his royal entourage. He climbed out of his carriage and greeted the king warmly.
"And where is my bride-to-be?" he asked.
He was shown into a reception hall where the princess was waiting.
"Princess," cried the prince, "you're even lovelier than your reputation had me believe."
The princess smiled and bowed, but would not open her mouth to speak.
"What's the matter?" said the prince. "Have I struck you dumb with my good looks?"
The princess blushed and shook her head.
"Ah," the prince replied, "then you don't find me handsome. Is that it?"
Alarmed, the princess shook her head again. That wasn't what she'd meant at all, but she could see she was only making things worse.
"Say something, girl. This is no time to be tongue-tied," hissed the king.
"Pardon me, sire," said the handmaiden, "but perhaps the princess will be more comfortable speaking with the prince for the first time in private." The princess nodded gratefully.
"It isn't proper," the king grumbled. "I suppose under the circumstances."
His guards showed the prince and princess to a room where they could be alone.
"Well,"
said the prince, once the guards had gone,
"what do you think of me?"
Covering her mouth with her hand, the princess said,
"I think you're very handsome."
"Why do you hide your mouth when you speak?" the prince asked.
"It's my habit," the princess replied. "I'm sorry if you find it strange."
"You are strange, but I could learn to live with it, given your beauty."
The princess's heart soared, but then crashed back to earth just as quickly. It would only be a matter of time before the prince discovered her secret. Though she could have waited until they married to reveal it, she knew it wasn't right to deceive him.
"I have something to confess," she said, still speaking with her mouth covered. "And I'm afraid that when you learn what it is, you won't want to marry me."
"Nonsense," said the prince. "What is it? Oh, no. We're cousins, aren't we?"
"It isn't that," she said.
"Well," the prince said confidently, "there's nothing that could stop me wanting to marry you."
"I hope you're a man of your word," said the princess.
And then she took away her hand and showed him her forked tongue.
"Stars above!" cried the prince, recoiling.
"That's not all,"
said the princess, and slipping one arm out of her dress, she showed him the scales that covered her back. The prince was flabbergasted, then furious.
"I could never marry a monster like you," he cried. "I can't believe you and your father tried to trick me."
"He didn't," she said. "My father doesn't know anything about it."
"But he's going to," the prince fumed. "This is an outrage."
He stormed out of the room to go tell the king, and the princess chased after, begging him not to. It was just then that 5 Frisian assassins, who had disguised themselves as chefs, pulled daggers from their cakes and ran from the kitchens towards the king's room. The prince was just about to reveal the princess's secret when they broke down the door. While the assassins killed his guards, the cowardly king dove into a wardrobe and hid himself beneath a pile of clothes. The assassins turned on the prince and princess.
"Don't kill me," the prince cried. "I'm just an errand boy from another land." "Nice try," said the lead assassin. "You're the prince of Galatia, and you're here to marry the princess and form an alliance against us. Prepare to die."
The prince ran to a window and tried to force it open, leaving the princess to face the assassins by herself. As they came toward her with their bloody daggers drawn, she felt a strange pressure building behind her tongue. One after another, they lunged at her. One after another, the princess launched streams of venomous poison into their faces, and all but one fell writhing to the ground and died. The fifth assassin fled from the room, terrified, and escaped. The princess was as surprised as anyone. It was something she'd never known she could do. Then again, she'd never been threatened with death before. The prince, who was already halfway out the window, pulled himself back into the room and regarded both the dead assassins and the princess with amazement.
"Now will you marry me?" the princess said.
"Absolutely not," he replied. "But as a token of my gratitude, I won't tell your father why."
He grabbed a discarded dagger and rushed from assassin to assassin, stabbing their dead bodies.
"What are you doing?" said the bewildered princess.
The king emerged from his wardrobe.
"Are they dead?" he said, his voice trembling. "Yes, your majesty," said the prince, holding up the dagger. "I killed them all."
The princess was shocked by his lie, but held her tongue.
"Magnificent!" cried the king. "You're the hero of Frankenburg, my boy, and on your wedding day, no less."
"Ah, about that," the prince said.
"Regretfully, there will be no wedding."
"What?"
shouted the king.
"Why not?"
"I've just received word that the princess and I are cousins," said the prince.
"Such a shame."
And without so much as a backward glance, the prince slipped out of the room, gathered his entourage, and took off in his carriage.
"This is preposterous," the king fumed. "That boy is no more my daughter's cousin than I'm this chair's uncle. I won't allow my family to be treated this way."
The king was so enraged that he threatened to go to war with Galatia. The princess knew she couldn't allow this to happen, and so one evening she requested an audience with her father alone and revealed the secret she'd been hiding so long. He called off his war plans, but he was so angry with his daughter and so humiliated that he locked her in the dankest cell of his dungeon.
"Not only are you a liar and a beast," he said, spitting through the bars of her cell, "you're not marriageable."
He said it as if that were the greatest sin of all.
"But, father," said the princess, "I'm still your daughter, aren't I?"
"Not anymore,"
the king replied, and turned his back on her. The princess knew she could use her acidic venom to burn through the lock of her cell door and escape, but instead she waited, hoping her father might come to his senses and forgive her. For months she subsisted on gruel and shivered through the nights on a stone slab, but her father did not come. The princess's only visitor was her handmaiden. One day the handmaiden arrived with news.
"Has my father forgiven me?" the princess asked eagerly.
"I'm afraid not," the handmaiden replied.
"He's told the kingdom you're dead. Your funeral is tomorrow."
The princess was heartbroken. She broke out of the dungeon that very night, escaped the palace, and with her handmaiden she left the kingdom and her old life behind. They travelled incognito for months, wandering the land, taking domestic work where they could find it. The princess smeared her face with dirt so she would not be recognised, and never opened her mouth to anyone but the handmaiden, who told people that the dirty-faced girl she'd travelled with was mute. Then one day they heard a story about a prince in the faraway kingdom of Thrace, whose body sometimes assumed a form so peculiar that it had become a national scandal.
"Could it possibly be true?" said the princess. "Could he be like me?"
"I say it's worth finding out," the handmaiden replied. So they set out on a long journey. It took 2 weeks to cross the pitiless waste on horseback, and 2 weeks more to cross the Great Cataract by ship. When they finally arrived in the kingdom of Thrace, they were sunburned, windburned, and nearly broke. "I couldn't possibly meet the prince looking like this," the princess said. So they spent the last of the money they'd earned and went to a bathhouse, where they were washed and perfumed and anointed with oils. When they emerged, the princess looked so beautiful that she turned the heads of everyone who saw her, male or female. "I'll show my father I'm marriageable," the princess said. "Let's go meet this peculiar prince." So they went to the palace and asked for him, but the answer they got was disappointing indeed.
"I'm sorry,"
a palace guard told them, but the prince is dead.
What happened? Asked the handmaiden.
He fell ill with a mysterious disease and died in the night, said the guard. It was all very sudden.
That's exactly what the king said happened to you, the handmaiden whispered to the princess.
That night they snuck into the palace dungeon, and in the darkest, dankest cell, they found a giant garden slug with the head of a rather handsome young man.
Are you the prince? The handmaiden asked him.
I am, the repulsive thing answered.
When I'm feeling dejected, my body turns into a gelatinous, quivering mass. My mother finally found out and locked me down here, and now, as you can see, I've become a slug, almost head to toe. The prince wriggled towards the bars of his cell, his body leaving a dark stain on the floor behind him. I'm sure she'll come to her senses any day now, though, and let me out.
The princess and the handmaiden exchanged an awkward glance.
Well, I have good news and bad news, said the handmaiden. The bad news is your mother's told everyone you're dead.
The prince began to wail and moan, and immediately a pair of gelatinous antennae began to grow from his forehead. Now even his head was turning slug.
Wait, the handmaiden said, there's still the good news.
Oh, yes, I forgot, the prince sniffled, and the antennae stopped growing. What is it?
This is the Princess of Frankenburg, said the handmaiden.
The princess stepped forward into a pool of light, and for the first time the prince saw her fantastic beauty.
You're a princess?
The prince stuttered, his eyes going wide.
That's right, said the handmaiden. And she's here to rescue you.
The prince was thrilled.
I don't believe it, he said. How?
His antennae were shrinking back into his head, and the tube-like mass of his upper body was already beginning to separate into arms and a torso.
Just like that, he was turning human again.
Like this, said the princess, and she spat a stream of venomous acid into the lock of the prince's cell door. It began to hiss and smoke as the lock melted. The prince recoiled in alarm.
What are you? He said.
I'm peculiar, like you, the princess replied. When my father found out my secret, he disowned me and locked me up, too. I know just how you're feeling.
As she spoke, her forked tongue flicked from her mouth.
And your tongue, the prince said, that's part of what's wrong with you?
And this, the princess said, and she slipped an arm from her dress and showed him the scales across her back.
I see, said the prince, his voice sorrowful again. I should have known this was too good to be true.
As a tear rolled down his cheek, his arms began to disappear, joining again with his torso in a wobbly mass of slug flesh.
Why are you sad? The princess said. We're a perfect match. Together we could show our parents that we're not unmarriageable and we're not trash. We can unite our kingdoms, and one day, perhaps, take our rightful place on the throne.
You must be mad, the prince shouted. How could I ever love you? You're a disgusting freak.
The princess was speechless. She couldn't believe what he was saying.
Oh, this is so humiliating, the slug prince bawled.
And then antennae sprung from his forehead. His face disappeared, and he became a slug from head to toe, quivering and moaning as he struggled to cry without a mouth. The princess and the handmaiden turned away, stomachs heaving, and left the ungrateful prince to rot in his dungeon.
I believe I'm done with princes forever, the princess said, peculiar or otherwise.
They crossed the great cataract and the pitiless waste once again, and returned to Frankenburg to find it at war with both Galatia and Frisia, which had united against it. The king had been overthrown and jailed, and the Frisians had installed a duke to govern Frankenburg. The duke was a bachelor, and once his rule had been established and the country pacified, he began searching for a bride. The duke's emissary discovered the princess working in an inn.
"You there!" he shouted.
calling her away from a table she was cleaning.
"The Duke is looking for a bride."
"Good luck to him," she replied. "I'm not interested."
"Your opinion doesn't matter,"
the emissary replied.
"Come with me at once."
"But I'm not royal," she lied.
"That doesn't matter either. The Duke merely wants to find the most beautiful woman in the kingdom, and that may well be you."
The princess was beginning to regard her beauty as something of a curse. She was given a nice dress to wear and brought before the Duke. When she saw his face, a cold chill spread through her. This Frisian Duke had been one of the assassins who had come to kill her. He was the lone assassin who had fled.
"Do I know you from somewhere?"
the Duke said.
"You look familiar."
The princess was tired of hiding and tired of lying, so she told the truth. "You tried to kill me once, and my father. I was once the Princess of Frankenburg."
"I thought you were dead," said the Duke.
"No," she replied, "that was a lie my father made up."
"Then I'm not the only one who tried to kill you,"
he said, and smiled. "I suppose not."
"I like your honesty," said the Duke, "as well as your fortitude. You're made of strong stuff, and we Frisians admire that. I can't make you my wife because you might murder me in my sleep, but if you'll accept the position, I'd like to appoint you as my advisor. Your unique perspective would be valuable indeed."
The princess happily accepted. She moved back into the palace with her handmaiden, took a position of prominence in the Duke's government, and never again covered her mouth when she spoke, as she no longer had to hide who she was. After some time had passed, she paid her father a visit in the dungeons. He was wearing grimy sackcloth, and not looking very kingly at all.
"Get out of here,"
he growled at her.
"You're a traitor, and I have nothing to say to you."
"Well, I have something to say to you," the princess replied. "Though I'm still angry at you, I want you to know you are forgiven. I understand now that what you did to me wasn't the action of an evil man, but a common one."
"Fine, thank you for the wonderful speech," said the king. "Now go away."
"As you wish," said the princess. She started to go, then stopped at the doorway. "By the way, they're planning to hang you in the morning." At this news, the king curled into a ball and began to snivel and cry. It was such a pathetic sight that the princess was moved to pity. Despite all her father had done, she felt her bitterness toward him melting away. She used her venom to melt the lock from his cell, secreted him out of the jailhouse, disguised him as a beggar, and sent him running in the same direction she had once fled the kingdom. He did not thank her, nor even look back at her. And then he was gone, and she was gripped by a sudden, wild happiness, for her act of kindness had freed them both. The First Imbrin.
Editor's note. While we can be certain that many of the tale's characters really lived and walked the earth, it can be difficult to confirm much of their factualness beyond that. In the centuries before our stories were written down, they were disseminated as oral tradition, and thus highly subject to change, each teller embellishing the tales as she saw fit. The result is that today they are more legend than history, and their value, beyond simply being compelling stories, is primarily as moral lessons. The story of Britain's first Imbrin, however, is a notable exception. It is one of the few tales whose historical authenticity can be thoroughly accounted for, the events it describes having been verified not only by many contemporaneous sources, but by the Imbrin herself, in her famous book of encyclical addresses, A Gathering of Tail Feathers. That is why I consider it the most significant of the tales, it being equally a moral parable, a ripping good yarn, and an important chronicle of peculiar history. Millard Nullings.
The First Imbrin wasn't a woman who could turn herself into a bird, but a bird who could turn herself into a woman.
She was born into a family of goshawks, fierce hunters who didn't appreciate their sister's habit of becoming a fleshy, earthbound creature at unpredictable times, her sudden changes in size toppling them out of their nest, and her odd, babbling speech spoiling their hunts. Her father gave her the name Imin, which in the shrill language of goshawks meant strange one, and she felt the lonely burden of that strangeness from the time she was old enough to hold up her head. Goshawks are territorial and proud, and love nothing more than a good bloody fight. Imin was no different, and when a turf war erupted between their family and a band of harriers, she fought bravely, determined to prove she was every bit the goshawk her brothers were. They were outnumbered by the larger, stronger birds, but even when his children began to die in the skirmishes, Imin's father would not admit defeat. In the end, they repelled the harriers, but Imin was wounded, and all her siblings but one were killed. Wondering what it had all been for, she asked her father why they had not simply run away and found another nest to live in. "We had to defend the honour of our family," he told her. "But now our family is gone," Imin replied. "Where's the honour in that?" "I don't suppose a creature like you would understand," he said. And straightening his feathers, he leapt into the air and flew away to go hunting. Imin did not join him. She had lost her taste for the hunt, and for blood and fighting, too, which for a goshawk was even stranger than turning into a human now and then. Perhaps she was never meant to be a hawk, she thought, as she winged down to the forest floor and landed on human legs. Perhaps she was born in the wrong body. Imin wandered for a long time. She lingered around human settlements, studying them from the safety of treetops. Because she had stopped hunting, it was hunger that gave her the nerve to finally walk into a village and sneak bites of their food. Roasted corn put out for chickens, pies left to cool on windowsills, unwatched pots of soup. And she found she had a taste for it. She learned some human language so that she could talk to them, and discovered that she enjoyed their company even more than their food. She liked the way they laughed and sang, and showed one another love. So she chose a village at random, and went to live there. A kindly old man let her stay in his barn, and his wife taught Imin to sew, so she would have a trade. Everything was going swimmingly, until a few days after she'd arrived, the village baker saw her turn into a bird. She hadn't yet grown accustomed to sleeping in human form, so every night she changed into a goshawk, flew up into the trees, and fell asleep with her head tucked under her wing. The shocked villagers accused her of witchcraft and chased her away with torches. Disappointed but undeterred, Imin went wandering again and found another village in which to settle. This time she was careful not to let anyone see her change into a bird. But the villagers seemed to distrust her regardless. To most people, Imin had a strange way about her. She had been raised by hawks, after all. And it wasn't long before she was chased from this new village, too. She grew sad, and wondered if there was any place in the world she truly belonged. One morning, on the verge of despair, she lay watching the sun rise in a forest glade. It was a spectacle of such transcendent beauty that it made her forget her troubles for a moment, and when it was over, she wished desperately to see it once more. In an instant, the sky went dark, and the dawn broke all over again, and she suddenly realized she had a talent other than her ability to change form. She could make small moments repeat themselves. She amused herself with this trick for days, repeating the leap of a graceful deer or a fleeting slant of afternoon sun, just so she could better appreciate their beauty, and it cheered her up immensely. She was repeating the first fall of virgin snow when a voice startled her. "Excuse me," he said, "but are you making that happen?" She spun round to see a young man wearing a short green tunic and shoes made from fish skin. It was an odd outfit, but stranger still was that he carried his head under the crook of his arm, disconnected entirely from his neck. "Excuse me," she replied, "but what's happened to your head?" "Frightfully sorry," he said, reacting as if he'd just realized his pants were unbuttoned, and with great embarrassment
he popped his head back onto his neck.
How rude of me.
He said his name was Engelbert, and as she had nowhere else to go, he invited her back to his camp.